Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
For the sixth year in a row, sexually transmitted diseases and infections are on the rise in the United States. That's according to the latest data from the Centers for Disease Control. According to the CDC, there were 2.5 million reported cases of chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis across the country in 2019. And while many Americans have been in quarantine for the past year, as the country begins to open up and more people get vaccinated, experts are concerned that we could see a spike in infections. For more on this, I'm joined by Professor Ina Park, the author of Strange Bedfellows, Adventures in Science, History, and Surprising Secrets of STDs. Ina, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Ina, I recall a time when, in the 1990s in particular, when the messaging around STDs and STIs was very clear. And largely that was because, I'm sure you recall, the rise of HIV and AIDS really brought to the forefront the need to practice safe sex. So when I saw these numbers, it was really surprising to me that this is the sixth year in a row that we've seen this increase. What's behind these numbers?
Well, I can't point to any one factor, but you're right. You and I grew up during a time where everyone knew what HIV was and how it was transmitted, and therefore, you know, we should know how to prevent it. But just because we knew how to prevent something didn't necessarily mean we did. And of course, we know that things like condoms and barriers do help prevent STIs and HIV, but a lot of other forces are at play here. One of which you already mentioned were the dating apps. So, you know, they have allowed the ability to create casual hookups with the efficiency that we never could have imagined before, and also allows mixing of sexual networks. So we used to have to go down to, you know, the local bar to meet somebody. And so you were, you know, generally hanging out in similar social circles, but now, you know, you can turn any location into a place where you might be able to meet someone to hook up for sex. So I think the efficiency, as well as the spread in geography, has, you know, changed the way that we connect with each other sexually in space and time. And then the other thing is that we are much less afraid as a society of HIV now, which is a wonderful thing, because now we have medications, antiretroviral therapy, that can prolong the lives of folks with HIV so that they have basically a normal lifespan. And when you take the medication, then you're, you know, unable, if your virus is suppressed, to transmit. So you have folks not afraid of HIV, able to hook up really easily. And then out here in California, Tanzania, we have a pretty serious problem with the methamphetamine epidemic. And then, of course, you know, the opioid epidemic nationally, which is very tied to syphilis, particularly among women and then pregnant women.
What do we know about sexual education in schools? I mean, that's another place where I recall learning a lot about safe sex practices and a lot of these STDs and STIs. Do we know whether that's still happening?
Well, I mean, I think you and I grew up in bubbles to a certain extent. That I was in California, you were in New York, and we had pretty medically accurate, skills-based sex education, where we were learning how to put on condoms and that type of thing. That is very unusual. Really, only 18 states in the United States actually dictate that the classes that you teach for sex education have to be medically accurate. You know, probably most of them are reasonably accurate. 39 states and the District of Columbia actually do mandate some form of sex education. But most of these, you know, are often disease-focused or harm-focused, and they don't certainly, you know, teach skills about negotiating things like consent or teaching folks how to use condoms necessarily. So I think the quality of sex ed that people are receiving is highly variable and often not very good.
The data that the CDC has put forth in this report is from 2019. And mm-hmm. Of course, everybody knows what happened in 2020 was that the world changed and we were all sent home. Some of us are slowly beginning to emerge from home, and that will probably mean more interactions. But before we get to what's on the horizon, Do we know about what happened during the pandemic in terms of people's sexual lives and potentially the spread of STDs and STIs?
Well, only in a preliminary way in terms of looking at CDC data, because it's not all complete yet, but they talked about you know, some of their preliminary 2020 data at the end of 2020 at their STD prevention conference. And it did look like in those, you know, early months of shelter in place that people truly were socially and sexually distancing from each other. But the other thing that was going on, Tanzina, was about two-thirds of sexual health clinics actually had to either shut their doors or greatly reduce their services. So I'm just going to take New York City, for example. They have 8 sexual health clinics, and they actually had to shut the doors on 7 of them. So if you can imagine, in a city that large, I really have only 1 sexual health clinic. So folks couldn't even get access to testing. And then, of course, you know, people truly did reduce their in-real-life sort of sexual interactions, but people certainly went online. I mean, Tinder had a record of 3 billion swipes on March 29th of 2020. So
no,
people
it did
were interacting.
Really?
Yes, 3 billion
really?
Swipes. And they were interacting with each other, but I think a lot of people early on were too freaked out to do, you know, sexual encounters in person. But just from my own patients that I see, I'll tell you, some people never stopped having casual sex. And then other people held up for a couple months, and then they just got right back on the horse again, so to speak.
We're starting to slowly reopen again in many parts of the country. And there are bars and restaurants opening up. And I suspect that there will be, as people become fully vaccinated, there will be a lot more sex happening. What does that tell us potentially about the future for STIs and STDs as we emerge from the pandemic?
Well, looking into my crystal ball, I have to say, in talking to some patients who have held out for quite a while and are now getting back out there, I think there is a little bit of making up for lost time, I have to say, Tanzina, where folks have felt deprived for such a long time, and that whole idea of quarantine fatigue is real. And so I think people feel like, hey, I deserve to have a great time. And even folks who were extraordinarily compliant with masking are not necessarily excited about using condoms. They don't translate for some reason. And it's interesting because I had just put out a piece last week in the Times with my colleague Peggy Orenstein, and she interviewed Lisa Wade over at Tulane, and she's interviewing college students who, as you know, are a pretty highly sexually active group. And even those with multiple partners report not using condoms, even though they do report, you know, being really compliant with masks. So I think in my crystal ball, I see a huge spike in STIs in 2021, but we'll see if I'm right or not.
Is that just because people don't assume that they will get something like gonorrhea or syphilis? You know, when I think about syphilis, I say, well, isn't that the thing that killed, you know, Elizabethan writers? And, you know, like,
right, exactly.
Or is it just because people don't think it's that serious?
I think people understand by now that an STI can enter the picture really at any time that you have sex. And I think that it's just that people aren't overly concerned or taking it as seriously. And now that folks are less afraid of HIV, I think they haven't placed a lot of importance, you know, on things like syphilis. And I do have to say, for a certain generation of physicians, including myself, we almost eliminated syphilis in this country in 1999 and 2000. So now that it's surged again, we have an entire generation of physicians who's also not familiar with seeing it. And so we're not counseling about it necessarily. And so I think there's a combination of folks just not feeling like it's going to cause any long-term effects. And of course, you and I both know, not just syphilis, but gonorrhea, chlamydia, and other STIs can certainly cause a whole host of complications. So, you know, I definitely advocate for folks to, you know, get out there and get tested, regardless of whether or not they're going to use protection.
Well, let's talk about testing, because I wonder how much is assumed that you're being tested for, how much when you go to your gynecologist or urologist, you know, what exactly can you get tested for?
Right. So you can get tested for the, you know, the 3 big bacterial STIs that CDC reports on, which are gonorrhea, chlamydia, and syphilis, are pretty much standard across the board. Of course, everyone can get tested for HIV. There are tests for human papillomavirus, or HPV, which right now are only done with folks with the cervix when it's done during like the pap smear procedure, pelvic exam. And then, there are blood tests for herpes. I have a chapter about this in my book because they're very prone to false positives. And so we only do that herpes test in very certain circumstances, because when you get a result, it's sometimes hard to interpret. So one thing that is easier to interpret, which everyone is familiar with, are these PCR tests. So if somebody actually has something going on, like a genital lesion, Those PCR tests, which are really similar to the COVID tests that we're all familiar with, are very accurate at diagnosing herpes. But for a standard sort of test me for STDs panel, it would really just be gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis, and then sometimes HIV.
People would have to ask for HIV or HPV if they wanted that test.
Yeah, they shouldn't have to ask for HIV. I wish it would, always be included. But it's always good to ask sort of, what are you testing me for? Mm-hmm. But HPV, really, there's no FDA approved test for men. So in general, men should not be getting tested for HPV.
The Department of Health and Human Services has an STI national strategic plan. Your thoughts on it?
Oh, I'm so excited about this. I mean, this is the first ever plan. We have one for HIV. And this plan, National Strategic Plan, just went into place in 2021. And one of my favorite aspects about it, well, there's two. The first is that they want to have a non-stigmatizing, comprehensive approach to sexual health education and sexual well-being. And that sounds completely reasonable, but that will be a huge lift if we're actually able to get our nation to a place where everyone is receiving that sort of comprehensive sex ed. And then the second thing is there's a goal to try to reduce the stigma around sexually transmitted infections and HIV, because as you know, stigma is still a huge issue that prevents folks from testing because they're embarrassed or they're afraid that they might be rejected if they actually have an STI and then have to tell their partner.
Ina Park is the author of Strange Bedfellows, Adventures in Science, History, and Surprising Secrets of STDs. Ina, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tanzi, and it was great to be here.